Chapter 41. Nearing the ferry building, Bell threw a blanket over his head as he drove through a shower of cinders. He could see that Chinatown was gone, leaving little more than hundreds of piles of charred, smoldering ruins. The ferry building had survived with only minor damage to its clock tower. Bell noted that the clock had stopped at 5:12, the time the earthquake struck. The streets and sidewalks around the ferry building looked like a vast mob scene. Thousands were fleeing, believing the entire city would be destroyed. There was pandemonium and bedlam in the jumbled mass of people, some wrapped in blankets and loaded down with what possessions they were able to carry onto the ferry boat. Some pushed baby buggies or toy wagons, and yet, amid the nightmare, everyone was gracious, courteous, and considerate toward others. Bell stopped beside a young man who seemed to be merely standing around and watching the fire across the street from the wharves. He held up a $20 gold piece. "If you know how to drive a car, take this one to the customs house and turn it over to Horace Bronson of the Van Dorn Detective Agency, and this is yours." The young man's eyes widened in anticipation, not so much from the money but the chance to drive an automobile. "Yes, sir," he said brightly. "I know how to drive my uncle's Maxwell." Bell watched with amusement as the boy clashed the gears and drove off down the crowded street. Then he turned and joined the mass of humanity that was escaping the destruction of the city. Within 3 days, over 225,000 people left the peninsula where San Francisco stood, all carried free of charge by the Southern Pacific Railroad to wherever they wished to travel. Within 24 hours of the quake, overloaded ferry boats were departing San Francisco for Oakland every hour. Bell showed his Van Dorn credentials and boarded a ferry called the Buena Vista. He found an open place to sit above the paddle wheels and turned back to watch the flames shooting hundreds of feet into the air, with the smoke rising over 1,000 feet. It looked as if the whole city was one vast bonfire. Once he stepped off the mole in Oakland, a railroad official directed him to the repair shop where his locomotive was sitting. The mammoth steel monster was a grand sight up close. It was painted black from the cowcatcher to the rear of its coal tender. Bell guessed the cab's roof was at least 15 feet above the rails. The big drive wheels were 81 inches in diameter. In its time, the Atlantic-type locomotive was a masterwork of mechanical power. To Bell, it looked mean and ugly. The number 3455 was painted in small white letters on the side of the cab. Southern Pacific, in larger type, ran across the side of the tender, which fueled the boiler with coal and water. Bell walked up to a man wearing the traditional striped engineer's coveralls and striped cap with brim. The man held a big oil can with a long spout and looked to be oiling the bearings on the connecting rods running from the piston cylinder to the drive wheels. "A mighty fine locomotive," said Bell admiringly. The engineer looked up. He was shorter than Bell, with strands of salt-and-pepper hair straying from under his cap. The face was craggy from years of leaning out a cab window into the full wind stream from a speeding engine. The eyebrows over a pair of sky-blue eyes were curved and bushy. Bell judged he was younger than he looked. "None better than the Adeline," the engineer answered. "Adeline?" "Easier to remember than her four-figured number. Most locomotives are given a woman's name." "Adeline looks very powerful," said Bell admiringly. "She's built for heavy passenger service. Came out of the Baldwin Works no more than 5 months ago." "How fast will she go?" asked Bell. "Depends on how many cars she's hauling." "Let's say none." The engineer thought a moment. "On a long, straight stretch of open, empty track, she'd top 100 miles an hour. "My name is Bell." He handed the engineer the paperwork. "I've chartered your engine for a special job." The engineer studied the papers. "Van Dorn detective outfit, huh? What's so special?" "Ever hear of the Butcher Bandit?"
"Who hasn't?
I've read in the newspapers he's about as deadly as they come. Bell wasted no detailed explanation. We're going after him. He chartered a Pacific-type locomotive to haul his special private car. He's steaming to Salt Lake City before heading north for the Canadian border. I reckon he has a 5-hour head start. More like 6 by the time we take on coal and get a load of steam up. I was told there were repairs. Are they completed? The engineer nodded. The shop replaced a faulty bearing in one of the truck wheels. The sooner we get going, the better. Bell paused to extend his hand. By the way, my name is Isaac Bell. The engineer's shake was vigorous. Nils Lofgren. My fireman is Marvin Long. Bell pulled his watch from its pocket and checked the time. I'll see you in 45 minutes. We'll be at the coal loading dock just up the track. Bell hurried toward the Oakland terminal until he came to a wooden building that housed the Western Union office. The wire chief told him that only one wire was open to Salt Lake City, and it was hours behind getting messages through. Bell explained his mission, and the chief was most cooperative. "What's your message?" he asked. "I'll see that it's sent straight away to our office in Salt Lake." Bell's wire read, "To the Van Dorn office director, Salt Lake City. Imperative you stop locomotive hauling freight car number 16455. It is carrying the Butcher Bandit. Use every precaution. He is extremely dangerous. Seize and hold until I arrive. Isaac Bell, Special Agent." He waited until the telegrapher tapped out the message before leaving the office and walking to where Lofgren and Long were taking on coal and water. He climbed up into the cab and was introduced to Long, a heavy, broad-shouldered man with large muscles stretching the sleeves of his denim shirt. He wore no hat, and his red hair almost matched the flames inside the door to the firebox. He pulled off a leather glove and shook Bell's hand with a hand that was hard and calloused from long hours wielding a coal shovel. "Ready whenever you are," announced Lofgren. "Let's do it," answered Bell. As Long stoked the fire, Lofgren took his seat on the right side of the cab, locked the reverser Johnson bar into place, opened the cylinder cocks, and pulled the rope above his head down twice, causing the steam whistle to scream and about to move forward warning. Then he gripped the long throttle lever and pulled it back. Adeline began to move and slowly gather speed. 10 minutes later, Lofgren was signaled to switch onto the main track east. He eased the throttle back and the big Atlantic began to move forward. Slowly, the train wound through the yard. Long began maintaining his fire, light, level, and bright. In the 5 years he'd stoked locomotive fires, he'd developed a technique that kept the fire from burning too thin or too thick. Lofgren yanked on the throttle, the drive wheels churned amid a loud blast of steam, and black smoke spewed out the top of the stack. Bell took the seat on the left side of the cab, feeling vastly relieved that he was at last on what he felt certain was the final chase to catch Cromwell and hand him over to the authorities in Chicago, dead or alive. He found the vibration of the locomotive over the rails as soothing as floating in a rubber raft on a mountain lake, the chug of the steam propelling the drive wheels and the warm heat from the firebox positively restful for a man on a mission. Before they reached Sacramento and swung east across the Sierra Nevada mountains, Bell slid down in his seat, yawned, and closed his eyes. Within a minute, he was in a sound sleep amid the clangor of the speeding locomotive as Adeline aimed her big cowcatcher toward the Sierra Nevadas and Donner Pass.